Thank you for tuning in to the WOLA podcast, Latin America Today. It's Tuesday, September 10th, 2013. I'm Adam Isaacson. I'm the Senior Associate for Regional Security Policy here at WOLA. And I'm on the phone with Joe Eldridge. Joe is the University Chaplain of American University and also a Senior Adjunct Professorial Lecturer there in the School of International Service. Hello, Joe.
Hi.
Hi, thank you for joining us today. Joe,
My pleasure.
Joe is also the founder, the co-founder, anyway, of WOLA back in 1974, 39 years ago, and served as its first director for several years. So it's a real honor to have you here. But tomorrow, I wanted to talk to you today because tomorrow is, as many people know, the 40th anniversary of the September 11th, 1973 coup in Chile that brought dictator Augusto Pinochet into power, where he would be for the next 17 years. And you were in Chile at the time, correct?
That's correct.
I had been there.
I had arrived, frankly, a couple of days after the election of Salvador Allende, which was filled with promise and hope for peaceful, constitutional, sweeping, profound social and political change that would address the great inequalities and particularly the vast majority of the Chileans, which at that time were poor. So there was great hope attached to his presidency, and it all, of course, came crashing down on September the 11th. Now, there was a turbulent lead-in with an attempted coup, or what's called a tancazo, in June. So people were kind of on tenderhooks, so wondering what was going to happen. There was a sense that something was going to happen, but nobody, I mean nobody, expected that what happened on September the 11th with the massive brutality and violence that accompanied the coup would occur. Nobody
was counting on that.
Because Chile had a long history of constitutional government.
Right. It had not had a history of civil wars or even major uprisings. I mean, the sump, but nothing. You were in Chile at the time. Where in the country were you?
I was living and working in a working class neighborhood just on the edge of Santiago.
Uh-huh.
And I woke up on September the 11th to martial music. All the stations and the radio stations had been taken by the military, with the exception of one, in which Allende was given the last broadcast from the Moneda, the presidential palace. And from my neighborhood, I could see smoke rising from downtown Santiago, which later on that afternoon, we were to learn that the Hawker Hunters, fighters, had bombed the presidential palace. And the country was a lockdown. There was a 24-hour curfew announced. Tanks were rolling down the streets of my neighborhood. And I remember around noon when the full impact of, or I don't think the full impact of what was happening, but we were getting a sense for what was happening. People poured out. This was a popular unity neighborhood.
That was Allende's party. Yeah.
This was Allende's coalition party, and our neighbors, my neighbors, were either communists or socialists, and they had their quarrels. But when the with the coup, people poured out of their neighborhood, poured out on the streets. People embraced each other because we had a foreboding sense for what was to lie in store for us. And indeed, the next few days were this was going to play out now, in a very dramatic way.
Just to frame this, I mean, when people think of coups in Latin America, I mean, like Honduras, they come to the soldiers come to the presidential palace and escort the president out. Or Venezuela in 2002, you had, you know, a few skirmishes around some barracks, but not much else outside of the capital. In Chile, this was something that lasted several days. This was it looked like they were almost reconquering the capital in a very brutal way.
Exactly. Here's the way I think about it. I mean, here on this university campus, we have what are called the AU Dems, the Democrats, and the AU Republicans.
Mm-hmm.
What if tomorrow, let's say, either group were to declare a state of siege, and simply for the fact of having been a member of one or the other group, you could be hunted down, made to disappear, subjected to torture, and held in clandestine detention centers. So what I was doing on September the 10th was, which was frankly working in this neighborhood and working in an alliance with some programs that the Popular Unity was trying to get organized. I was well known in this neighborhood and in this barrio. Mm-hmm. And for what I was doing on September the 10th, I could be detained and, sure, and disappeared on September the 11th. So it, you're absolutely, and there's no recourse. I mean, if there's a 23, if there's a, in the beginning there was a, you know, 22-hour curfew or 20-hour curfew. So the only people operating during the day and are in the, at night are security forces.
The entire city indoors otherwise.
The entire city was shut down. Now, as days progressed, they began to open up greater windows of opportunity to move around the city. But in the beginning, it was almost a total lockdown. And so, but even if there's a, you know, 14-hour curfew, if you're the only people operating are the security forces.
Right.
They're the people on the streets. So you can be detained and disappeared, and nobody's going to know about it.
No witnesses, yeah.
No witnesses. So that was what was happening. And I was also involved with a group of mostly Catholic mission people, and we were trying to document U.S. intervention in Chile, and we had a little. They were Mary Knollers. Mary Knoll priests had a center, and in the back of that, or a residence, in the back of that residence was an outbuilding, and we had a little office in that outbuilding. The coup was on a Tuesday morning. 5 days later, the security forces burst into that office and detained the two Mary Knollers who happened to be in the on the premises. It was on a Sunday. It was on a Sunday morning, and they ransacked the files, and they and it was a scary time.
And that happened to just about every non-governmental organization.
That happened. Yeah. Any non-governmental organization who had any identification or any sympathy whatsoever for the Allende government was targeted.
And those who ran the Mary Knoll office, for instance, what happened to them?
They were taken to the soccer stadium.
Oh,
they
dear.
Were, and I don't know if anybody who listens is listening to this has ever seen the movie Missing with Sissy Spacek and Jack Lemmon.
Mm-hmm. From the 1980s.
Made in the 1980s. Mr. Horman, which is Ed Horman, Charles Horman is a North American citizen who disappeared and was killed by the Pinochet government. We, from our little group, got together and went to the embassy on Monday morning after our friends and colleagues had been taken away and disappeared in the soccer stadium.
This
and we went to the embassy.
After the coup. Okay. Mm-hmm.
This is the day. This is 6 days after the coup. Mm-hmm. We went to the embassy on a Monday morning, and to try to find out the whereabouts and learn anything we could, and solicit the support of the United States in helping us find out where our friends were.
Mm-hmm.
And we had the door slammed in our face.
You got no help for even.
We got no. Not only did we not get any help, the inference was that we brought this on ourselves because of our sympathy for the previous government. We were responsible for the disappearance of our friends, and they completely washed their hands of anything whatsoever to do with helping us.
And this is a time when you're still worried about your own security, I imagine.
This is
a
time
when
this is a time when I'm very worried about my own. I'm scared. I'm petrified.
And your own government is slamming the door. Interesting.
And our own government is slamming the door. And that is depicted in this very powerful film by Costa Gavras, called Missing, which I encourage folks to check out.
I'll include a link to it in the show notes for the podcast. It is a must-see movie if you have not.
It is a must-see movie. It captures really the terror that we all felt in the days following the military coup. And so that's what happened to me. Now, when the files are confiscated, I left home. I went to I In fact, I moved up that neighborhood. I went to stay with some friends who lived in what's called the Barrio Alto, the wealthy neighborhood where there was not much military presence, mm-hmm. and where everybody, most people supported Pinochet. And I stayed with friends who were kind of apolitical, but who mm-hmm. took me in because I didn't want to be disappeared. Honestly,
yeah. Had you stayed in that neighborhood where the military presence was greater, yeah, that would have not. Well, I'm glad that you
and,
had some place
left,
to go.
I left Chile about the end of October. I left Chile. We rallied and we tried to help. Chile
you were
was
there
locked.
That long? Wow.
Chile was closed for 2 weeks. Nobody could get in or out.
Mm-hmm.
After that, journalists started to come in, and we could move around the city. We knew the city, and we started working with the journalists to try to help identify for them, taking them, showing them where the morgue was, taking them to the morgue. Mm-hmm. I mean, just trying to help them get their story, to get the story out about what was transpiring in Chile, because, you know, the Pinochet government was saying this is a restoration of democracy. This is we're doing this in behalf of, you know, of God, country, and
sweeping out the communists, right?
Sweeping out the communists who were threatening this awful, they called it Plan Zeta. They were, which was fiction, but mm-hmm. they were hanging on every pretext to justify the intervention. Of course, this was done. We have to know. We know now, with the support. Not only acquiescence, but the United States was deeply complicit in fostering and promoting the coup.
Now, how soon afterward did you learn about the U.S. role?
Well, it began to filter out, but the most documented information came out in Frank Church's hearings, which took place
in the U.S. Senate, sure.
In the United States Senate about a year and a half later.
Right.
Which I think is still a pivotal period of disclosure of what the CIA was doing to undermine and destroy this government that was... Remember, this is in the middle of the Cold War, and Washington and the Kissinger, Nixon people did not want to see another country go the way of Cuba. So they saw that it was a geopolitics. It was a chessboard, and Chile was a victim of their machinations. So, and this has been now fully documented. And this is with documents showing that there was at the highest level of the United States government the command to destroy the Chilean democracy,
right,
and to foment the coup.
There was an explicit green light from
explicit
Washington.
Explicit green light mm-hmm. from Washington.
Right.
Explicit, right.
So you yourself came back to the States that fall, you're learning more and more about the U.S. role. It seems to have at least affected your career path because you stayed in Washington.
I stayed in Washington. I had one overwhelming, overriding objective, because the United States had opened the spigots of economic and military aid. I was incensed that the United States was in rewarding this interruption in democratic government.
Military aid to Chile actually
military
increased.
Military aid to Chile, I mean, there was no aid to Chile at all during the end of the year, and
sure.
Suddenly there was massive amounts of U.S. military assistance flowing to Chile. That was unconscionable. And so, frankly, that's in some ways how the WOLA got started. It was in response to, an effort on the part of many people associated, related to faith-based institutions
mm-hmm.
who were appalled by this as well and said, we need to stop military aid to Chile. And so this was a driving force. And not only, and then there, of course, there was a coup in Uruguay, and their countries were falling like dominoes under the heel of brutal military dictatorships. So
That's
it
right.
not only became a call for no military aid to Chile, but to stop military aid to all these de facto despotic military dictatorships.
Right.
So that's how.
Argentina.
That's how. Mm-hmm. That not much gray, frankly. It was not much subtlety about. It was an effort, an all out effort to stop military assistance to these governments.
And what was it like? I mean, it's the mid 1970s. Yes, the church hearings were going on, but what was it like walking the halls of Congress or going to the State and Defense Departments and advocating for human rights in Latin America or for stopping military aid? Did people treat you like you were from Mars?
First of all, not a lot of people knew anything or cared about Latin America. There was not, well, in some ways that hasn't really changed. But
think it has, but yes.
A lot of people are much more, there's much more non-governmental other voices. U.S. policy was dominated by the State Department, by a couple of senior representatives and senators, and by blue ribbon commissions. It wasn't very democratic.
No other discussion. Mm-hmm.
Not much discussion. And certainly human rights was not part of anybody's agenda. Mm-hmm. Just governments did not raise human rights issues with other governments. It just wasn't done. It wasn't mm-hmm. part of the diplomatic protocol. So first of all, it was a question of helping to people first frame it in a human rights context. Adopt the language of the UN.
Start thinking with
and
this
new begin
way.
To find sympathetic ears in the United States Congress. And slowly but surely that began to happen. And it was because of the class of 1974, they called it the Watergate babies. There
sure.
were a bunch of new Democrats who came because of Watergate and Vietnam who were sympathetic. So we got an audience with these new members of Congress.
Sure.
And I'll be honest, there were people in the what was called the Inter-American Bureau, I think, the ARA, American Regional Affairs, in the Department of State, who wanted their colleagues to hear what Wola was saying.
From the very beginning.
Huh. Almost from the beginning. And
interesting.
There were people, most of the Department of State, of course, these were rebels inside the Department of State. They were heretics to the Kissinger Doctrine.
Sure.
But I remember on several occasions when a guy named Rudy Fimbres, I mean, probably a DAS or maybe lower than a DAS.
Deputy
I don't
Assistant
what he,
Secretary,
Deputy,
sure.
I don't remember what his title was. But he would invite me over to speak to small groups of diplomats.
Wow.
And give my version of events. Nobody in the White House, certainly, but there were some career diplomats who I think were uncomfortable with the policy, so that they did leave a crack open for some discussion. And we took advantage of every opportunity at wherever in the bureaucracy and in the Congress to give them a different version of events. And of course, also Don Fraser. We got to mention Don Fraser was having
the U.S. Congress
hearings. He was the chairman of the subcommittee on International Organization of Human Rights. He had been having hearings and accelerated the hearings. He had 150 hearings.
No kidding.
On human rights from about 1974 to 1976.
In one Congress. That's incredible.
And I think it pretty much in one, maybe one and a half Congresses. He had a number of. And so we worked very closely with him, and when we would get authentic voices who could share views with credibility about what was transpiring in Chile or Uruguay, Argentina, Brazil, we would bring mm-hmm. those to his attention, and he would inevitably call a panel from the State Department, mm-hmm. and then a panel of non-governmental organization panel, and eventually his view, their views of these disappearances and torture began to filter into the popular consciousness of the Congress at that time. And it led the Congress to adopt legislation by 1976, 77, conditioning every single dollar the United States spent on human rights.
Section 502B of the Foreign Assistance Act.
Section 502B. Right. So we got traction.
Yeah, you did, and it's an important lesson that, you know, that within government, in all branches, there are people who are trying to do the right thing, and you just need to give them the information and the cover they need to do their job.
That's right.
Yeah. And meanwhile, of course, you were leaning on them, I'm sure, to keep colleagues and friends alive back in Chile in the Southern Cone.
A lot of casework with individuals. And, of course, we had a network, and this was really before human rights reporting became so fashionable. There were not reports, but we had good, reliable information, data that was coming from our faith communities.
Uh-huh.
That was feeding into the, you know, World Council of Churches, the National Council of Churches, and we were channeling that information to whomever, including the American Commission on Human Rights, to the State Department, to members of Congress, so that they could use this information, this data, in their own arguments.
So then it was more just private communications and urgent communications more than these big footnoted reports that we
had. No footnoted reports. Mm-hmm. There were no footnoted reports. It was all, you know, documents, paper documents that were smuggled out or brought to us.
Wow.
And we did our best to authenticate them and be sure that we had the bona fides of the source of these documents, and that's right. What we used to try to change some minds and move the dial on some of these issues.
Wow, this is a story that one podcast isn't enough. It really needs to be told a lot more so we can understand it. And also, it's something really important to reflect on this 40th anniversary.
Well, thank you very much for the invitation to participate in this podcast. I'm very grateful to you. And this was the transformative event in my life, September the 11th, 1973. Yeah. I was a different person after that.
It was for too many people, yeah.
And it defined me. And not only defined me, but it defined a lot of people. So.
Well, I think it defined you for the better.
thank you so much, Adam.
Joe. And thank you for listening to Wola's Latin America Today. Please keep listening. We're up on iTunes and elsewhere. And please keep visiting Wola's website, www.wola.org. If you're finding these podcasts useful, please do consider going online, making a quick donation that helps keep us going. You can also find Wola on Facebook or on Twitter at Wola_ORG. Hasta pronto.